Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, good evening, everybody. This is Chris.
This is Beth, and we have Percy here.
Yeah, so if anybody's gotten accustomed to seeing Miss Yuna recently,
she's still with us, but she's in a room right now.
Yeah, she will not be making her appearance tonight, and we also... We told you last time, gosh, a lot has happened in the last 2 weeks.
So we have a sister for Yuna. Her name is Lulu. She's also in her room right now. They both have had some FaceTime together today and are a little wound up, so they need to calm down a wee bit. But this is our foster, Percy. He's going to be needing a forever home.
In a few weeks. Yeah, we got to get him through some shots and all that good stuff, but
I can get him on his camera. He's adorable. He's so adorable.
Yes, he is very adorable. You wouldn't know that just a week ago he was a
feral kitten.
A feral. He is all kinds of cuddly and cute
and faithful, as you can see.
And he will hoping somebody will get him a wonderful forever home in a few weeks once we get him through his shots and stuff like that. So
far he's got a clean bill of health, and now we're just working on the timeline for the shots.
So at some point after we manage to get Mr. Percy into a forever home, we will be bringing Yuna and Lulu back on.
Yes.
Or, well, Lulu on for the first time because nobody's had a chance to see her yet. But Lulu's going to be a permanent addition who joined us actually just a few days after our last show.
Yes.
So, yep, we got three kitty cats in the household, and they are keeping us on our toes.
We have kitty zones.
Yes. And... gosh, what else? Yeah, aside from the kitty cats,
maybe just a paracon. Fleetwood Paracon,
which was a lot of fun. Historic and haunted.
Yep.
Fleetwood Church. That's just about an hour and a half from here in Richmond.
And we went up by Brandywine Station.
Yep, that was organized by our friends with Transcend Paranormal and Spirit Guide Paranormal, and they did a fantastic fundraiser for this old church that they're working actively to restore. So. Raised some money for that and had a good day out there Saturday.
Yep. And if you'd like to do an investigation, you need to contact Spirit Guides. They're the team that works with Fleetwood Church and does the investigations out there. But it is possible to book an investigation.
Yep. So all kinds of fun stuff going on.
We got to see Daniel Klaus.
Yep.
He was on our cruise that happened right before COVID hit. And he runs the
Hinsdale House
up in New York.
Yep.
Another paranormal destination that you can go to and book to investigate. Both local, national, international teams have all booked to investigate there. In fact, he told me he only has 3 days in October. He doesn't have anything booked yet.
Which doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
It sounds like our, typical October.
Yeah. So he's doing fantastic. But another fun thing to go and... just remember right now, check your local restrictions with travel due to COVID.
New York.
New York.
But all kinds of fun stuff going on.
Friday.
Going Friday and Saturday, Haunted Nights events, they are going to be down at Historic Henricus.
Yeah.
And we are going to be there with them on Friday night.
Yep. As guest investigators working with RTL. RVA.
RVA Paranormal.
Is RTL there?
No.
I couldn't remember.
But, I'm going to be there with RVA Paranormal and the crew from the Twisted Realm and two of the Tennessee Wraith Chasers. So if you ever watch their shows, they'll have two of them down there too. So fun weekend. We're there Friday.
Friday night. I think they just released 8 tickets. This past weekend for Friday night, so there still might be a chance that you can get them.
Yep.
And I think they only have 5 tickets left for Saturday night.
Yep.
And that's the night that Transcend's going to be there.
Transcend's going to be there with them on Saturday. So all kinds of fun stuff coming up. And, of course, it's October, or it will be in just a matter of days. By this next weekend, it'll be October. We got our full October ghost tour schedule is up and posted, and tickets are selling fast. Particularly considering our limited capacities that we have due to the whole COVID thing. So if you want to join us for our ghost tour in October,
booking
your tickets. just as an indication, one of our tours on October 30th already is sold out. So it's going to be a very busy month, but we got a lot of opportunities for you to come on out and join us. And if you have can get a few friends together, we can possibly work out
doing them. Private slots available.
Yeah, private slots available, particularly Sunday through Thursday. So, but anyways, that's not why you all joined us tonight. I mean, it is. You joined us.
We got through the business stuff.
Yeah, that's the business stuff. What you came and tuned in for tonight is tonight's episode is about a location that most people are familiar with, but you maybe haven't heard of it referred to as this name, okay. Mount Desert Island. Now, Mount Desert Island is up in the state of Maine, and it is more famously known as the home of Acadia National Park and the town of Bar Harbor. So,
it involves much more than that, but yeah. Those are the two main things you know on this island.
Yeah, so that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. They have their fair number of spirits up that way, going back hundreds of years.
Yes, Native Americans had stories of the paranormal and spirits. And the very freaky things happening. So hundreds of years, if not thousands of years of stories.
Yep.
So
we got that. Just a handful to share with you tonight because, well, if we tried to share everything that we found, we'd be on here all night long.
We're not going to do that.
No, we're not going
to
do that.
Save the voice.
We need to save the voice. It is October, so we need to save the voice.
All right, so we're going to start with the Phantoms of Ledgelawn. Ledgelawn was a shingle-style manor house that overlooked the village of Bar Harbor. It was on an oversized lot. It was considered to be one of the most haunted mansions on the island with enough ghost sightings to fill an entire book. Percy, you made me lose it. Here it is. this involves tales of darkness and horror, and it frightens people even to this very day. And it was built in 1904, and it was one of the last remaining true cottages. And I use that term very loosely, but it's what they were considered at that point in time. It's a palatial estate built on a simple bungalow style with those types of elements. It once hosted lavish parties and balls with candlelight and orchestra music spilling out of their open windows, carriages lining the curving drives, and it was during one of these events that the famed Hope Diamond made an appearance on the neck of one of the illustrious guests. Y'all know what happens with the Hope Diamond when you wear it. It's not a good thing. Ledgelawn abruptly stopped its parties long before the golden age of the area had come to an end, and after a funeral took place in the cottage, a long era of doom and mystery started for the place. Surprisingly, the cottage actually escaped damage from the fire of 1947 that destroyed so much of Bar Harbor. The unstoppable flames came within inches of the cottage before something drove them away. It literally took a 90-degree angle and moved in another direction. The cottage then became an inn for many decades, and in 2010, it was purchased by Ocean Properties, and it's no longer open to the public, unfortunately, because I would have loved to have gone to see it.
Sounds like a fascinating place.
Yes.
But we do have some good stories for it, with it all the same.
Yes. It is known for a ghost that is a sinister specter of a young, dark-haired woman with madness in her smile. Think Pennywise. the legend is that this is Mary Margaret, who took her own life at Ledgelawn when her fiancé jilted her shortly before their wedding day. Mary Margaret was young, beautiful, and rich, but none of these could protect her from the broken heart and public humiliation caused by her fiancé. She went to the third floor of the mansion into the sewing room on the east side of the house where her wedding dress was hanging in a ghostly, mocking way. She put the gown on, and using her veil, she hung herself from the beams of the sloping ceiling. Somebody's trying to escape. It was a little while later that her family found her, and she was a ghastly parody of a blushing bride. Her face was so bruised from the hanging, it was nearly unrecognizable. The smile on her face was grotesque and straight out of a horror novel. So Mary Margaret has appeared on countless occasions, especially when the sewing room became one of the guest rooms at the inn. People who checked into room 326 would wake up to see the image of a woman in white floating in the moonlight at the foot of the bed. One guest saw a phantom veil hanging from the sloping ceiling all night, swaying in the breeze, in a dress that was not there. We're going to have to put Percy back in his little kennel. He's a little wound up. Give him the mouth.
There you go, buddy.
Don't swipe.
Okay. Carrying on.
Moving on. Next pitch. Eric Argon also freely walks the halls of the old state, manifesting herself elsewhere aside from being attached to the room where she died. Donna Greta, an elderly woman who only spoke Portuguese.
An elderly guest at the inn was ascending the grand staircase on the morning of her arrival, and she stopped to speak with a young, dark-haired woman. The elderly woman and the dark-haired woman had a very engaging and exciting conversation before parting ways. Though the entirety of the conversation, the nearby front desk staff looked on, very concerned for the elderly woman, who appeared to be having a very animated conversation with herself. When the elderly woman approached the front desk, the staff asked her if she was feeling okay. The woman replied that she was fine, but she was concerned for the young lady in the beautiful, long, white dress. She had seemed pleasant enough, but her smile was quite disturbing. The mansion's caretaker had his own haunting encounter with Mary. In October 2000, Mike recalled that he and the staff were shutting down the inn for the season. Mike had left the rest of the staff on the first floor when he went to inspect the guest rooms above. Despite all the doors being open and the lights on, there was an unshakable sense of gloom and confinement that kept building up in the mansion. After Mike finished inspecting each room, he turned out the lights to indicate that the job was done. No one came upstairs while Mike was working, and the further he got with his task, the darker it became. When he got to the third floor, things got weird. A light he had turned off suddenly turned back on. He turned it off again, turned to leave the room, and saw a quickly moving object out of the corner of his eye. Turning in his direction, he realized he was facing room 326. He watched as the specter of Mary Margaret's white form slipped out of an adjacent room, floated across the corridor and into room 326. As she passed by, she slowly turned her head around to make eye contact and flashed him an eerie grin. Mike realized that she had effectively trapped him at the end of the hallway with only one way in or out. Having sufficiently terrified a living soul for one day, Mary faded away, leaving the caretaker to share his tale as a warning to those who may discount Mary's continued presence at Ledgelaw. There is another spirit yet who also lingers on at Ledgelaw, and that is a young maid who served at the cottage for years after it was sold by the original owners. One morning she was found at the bottom of the back staircase by the other servants. Her neck was broken and twisted at a wholly unnatural angle. Rumor had it that someone pushed her down those stairs. She had been uncommonly pretty, and people in town had whispered that she was having an affair with the master of the house. Arguments ensued, but no one knows if it was the wife or the maid who made the untenable demands. Regardless of the circumstances, everything ended with the maid's quickly hushed-up death. The maid still makes her presence felt throughout the manor. She manifests herself as a feeling of dread or as a sensation of being watched when no one else is around. She moves through the cottage as an ice-cold draft on the hottest of summer days. On more vengeful days, she slams doors and the sounds of a heated argument are heard in rooms that are dark and empty. Her favorite place to manifest is in the suite that once housed the separate bedrooms of the master and the mistress. For years, a portrait of a man and woman hung in corresponding rooms. Guests and staff of the inn would be surprised to find the portrait of the man had been altered during the night. The glass of the picture frame was still in place, but the back of the canvas was now what was visible in the gilded frame. The maid apparently turns around at the portrait in a show of rage against her former master. Apparently, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned, even continues once that woman has passed on to the other side. Or maybe it was under contract. I mean, our ghost guys, they all have to come back and haunt someplace
yep.
after...
it's a requirement.
Yep, it's a requirement here with the company itself. That is the tale of Ledgelaw. That's just some of the spirits and hauntings that have occurred there over the years.
So we're going to talk about this great fire that we mentioned in 1947, and another one of the ghosts that come from the fire, or the horrible disaster that was the fire. Bar Harbor contains numerous signs of an enormous disaster. Again, the Great Fire of 1947. There are gates that lead to nowhere and ruined towers that reveal locations of mansions scored to the ground. Modern hotels have been built on the sites of other burned-out estates, and only the granite roadside walls survive today. A record drought followed by the extreme high winds proved to be a lethal mix in October of 1947 when the Great Fire broke out. That day, three separate fires started in the same cranberry field, but the last one was the one that raged out of control, and it was destined to destroy the town. It originated on Crooked Lake Road in Hull's Cove and swept south to Bar Harbor and Acadia National Park. More than a third of the park and half the town went up in flames while the National Guard worked with firefighters to control the blaze and evacuate the citizens. Months after the fire was out, Months after the fire was out, the peat was still burning 4 feet below the snow and seared them on meadow. So that just tells you how hot this fire burned, and it just continued to burn. 6 people perished in the Great Fire. 3 were from car accidents during the evacuation. 2 died of heart attacks and trying to escape the inferno, and 1 man burned to death. Animals were scorched as well, including 90,000 mice at Jackson Labs and 1 cat named Seawater. Seawater turns out to be one of the most famous ghosts from the fire. He was a black cat who belonged to Willie Cunningham. They lived on 4th Street, directly in the path of the fire as it swept across the Kibble Valley. An evacuation truck swept into the rescue Willie and Seawater in the nick of time. As they drove away, they could see his house burst into flames. Seawater panicked at this point, and he jumped from Willie's arms, leaping off the truck. Then he ran back to their burning home. Willie jumped from the truck to run after Seawater, and the evacuation crew had no choice but to leave them. Willie was last seen running through the smoke-filled street toward the fire. A week later, the fire went and had died down, and the residents started to return to their homes. A neighbor stopped by the ruins of Willie's house to make a gruesome discovery. Willie's charred bones are lying in a pile on the bank of a small stream that flows through a granite channel near the Forestry and Eagle Lake Road. The grief-stricken neighbor knelt to the ground in horror. The neighbor stared at the blackened skull and felt as though the empty eye sockets were staring back up at him. Turning around, the neighbor noticed a black cat sitting atop the steep eastern embankment. The cat stared down at Willie's skull as if they were communicating silently. The cat resembled Seawater, but a strange and terrifying transformation had occurred. A look at the utmost evil smoldered in the cat's red eyes. It ran a short distance before dissolving into thin air. Since then, Seawater keeps popping up in Bar Harbor near the stream by the ruins of Willie's house. At times, it manifests as a reflection on the dark surface of the slow-moving water. It also manifests in the nearby cement culvert for the stream, its red eyes glowing in the dark. At other times, he stalks up into town at the Village Green on Albert Meadows. He also stalks across the town rooftops. He always looks solid until he abruptly disappears. Then there's always an overwhelming sense of dread when he is seen. The spirits of the two Victorian ladies also make a strange pair of ghosts.
That's abrupt.
Sorry. I don't have those.
Yeah. We'll work off this.
Okay, go for
it. But yes, Seawater provides a vivid reminder of Bar Harbor's tragic past. Now, he's not the only one that comes around as a reminder to the fires that have occurred there over the years. On the slightly less sinister side, there are the spirits of two Victorian ladies that make a strange spectral pair as they come from before the Great Fire of 1947. As it turns out, Mount Desert Island has a long history of devastating fires going back for centuries. In terms of fire alone, the island has been scorched on countless occasions, leading Samuel Champlain to name the place the Isle de Mont Desert, the Isle of Bear Mountains, in 1605. These female spirits manifest themselves as the voices of two women from the 1800s. In the halls of different hotels, the spirits talk loudly in a bygone manner of speech, and as if looking for a room for the night, the two specters drag along large steamer trunks. Whenever a person investigates, the hotel corridors are empty and quiet. In a seance conducted at Clefstone Manor, communicated that they came from long ago and are condemned to eternal vigilance. For these ladies, their restless existence consists of ceaselessly traveling from inn to inn to prevent fire from breaking out and once again ravaging the town. Because so many guests had experiences with the ladies at Clefstone Manor, a rumor started that they died there during the Great Fire, but this is pure fabrication. Clefstone was one of the few mansions on Eden Street spared from the path of the flames. The ghosts simply appear to be friendly and perhaps very effective guardians. Bar Harbor has quite the history of fire, too. Almost matching that of Richmond, but Richmond and fire, not such a good mix.
Yeah, Bar Harbor and fire, not such a good mix.
Yeah, Bar Harbor as well, yes. So, next we are going on to what is called the Sinister Web of 1613.
I hit the wrong button. There it is. Okay. One of the most enduring ghost stories of Acadia concerns the spirit stalking the southwestern shores of Mount Desert Island. The ghosts of the dead Jesuits stir in a secret grotto, the Witching Spring, and in the deep shadows of Flying Mountain and St. Xavier Mountain. The short-lived settlement was once stood on Fernald Point in the southwest harbor, seen from above the Eagle Cliff, located on Flying Mountain. The regions below glisten like paradise with green points of land, stark blue water, mountains plunging into the sea, and the vista of Thumb Sound, the only natural fjord in the east coast of the United States. In the spring of 1613, a ship called the Jonas set out from France carrying 48 passengers. Among them was a group of young Jesuits hoping to start a religious colony in the New World. Their destination was Kananaskeg, Maine, on the Pembroke River. Blinding fog in Frenchman's Bay, together with fateful series of events, induced the young missionaries to abandon their trek inland and to start their city of God at the head of Thumb Sound on Mount Desert Island. They called the place Saint Xavier. In their idealism, they neglected to build fortifications or to make any plans for a defense. The first thing they did is build a chapel, and a lovely indeed it must have been, because the sounds of the ringing bells each morning actually brought the Pentecost Indians in for a visit with much curiosity and goodwill. Close ties and friendships were soon formed. The cheerful atmosphere was not to last, however. Late in the summer, an English warship arrived. The captain of the ship, Sam Argyle, was a deceitful and bloodthirsty man. He specifically sailed down to Acadia to obliterate any attempts at French settlement. Seeing the Jesuit colony, he bore down its ship on anchor and then headed in for the sound. The small crew on board hardly had any chance to send out a sign of friendly welcome before the English warship attacked. The warship unloaded its 14 guns and a shower of cannonballs and grape shot at the Jonas. When it was over, 8 Jesuits had died of wounds or drowning. Some wounded Frenchmen hid in a secret grotto shown to them by the Indians. This was a cavern on Fernald Point, and it has an underwater entrance that leads up into an air-filled cavern at the base of Flying Mountain. There, the wounded die, already entombed within the walls of Earth. Others fled up into the mountains, only to give themselves up later because they were starving. The survivors were sold into slavery or cast adrift on the open sea. Some bodies were placed in unmarked graves on Fernald Point, and Argyle even burned the cross of the chapel. The tormented souls of the murdered Jesuits haunt the region and offer warning to all who encounter them. They appear in the deep shadows of the Flying Mountain and Saint Xavier Mountain. At the Abbey's retreat, sometimes at the Gold Digger's Glen, leading to the theory that the fleeing Jesuits buried their supposed treasure there. The most haunted location is Jesuit Spring, located about two-thirds of the way down Fernald Point. Spellbinding and inaccessible, Jesuit Spring lives up to its reputation as a place of enchantment. Out of the crag of the rocks on the beach flows a stream of fresh and pure spring water. The spring spills over a little beach of silver sand and crushed shells that sparkle underwater when the tide is high. Despite its beauty, people rarely visit, and islanders avoid the place, knowing that boats docked there have a habit of disappearing. Many people have heard the sounds of men praying in a French accompanied by the splashing of oars. People sometimes see an apparition of a murdered Jesuit holding a cross and looking up with imploring eyes. Other times, the whole spring turns red, a ghastly river of blood. Tradition holds that the Jesuits haunt the spring because they may have been killed or buried nearby. This is the first major destruction of a European settlement on Mount Desert Island, and some think it puts casts a pall on the island, leading to the subsequent calamities in the centuries to follow. In hindsight, many question why the Jesuits settled at this point at all. Despite its beauty, their first encounter with the island as they broke through the fog was a scene to send a chill down your spine and induce sadness in your heart. As they sighted the beach, they noticed a large plume of smoke accompanied by wails of grief. There were witnesses to the funeral of a member of the native tribe. While many might consider this a bad omen, once the clouds broke and the sun shined down, the Jesuits saw paradise, and the rest is an unfortunate history.
Yep. Well, it's going back over 400 years up there on Mount Desert Island. Now, from here, we're going to take just a little bit of a hop, just a short way, kind of a little off of Mount Desert Island. There's another location just immediately across the water from Bar Harbor by the name of Compass Harbor. They like naming everything harbor up there.
There's a lot of harbors.
There's a lot of harbors. I mean, it's a very, very friendly shipping area. Yep. Lots of little areas for protection for ships to take harbor.
Yeah.
So, harbor. Now, Compass Harbor Nature Trail is less than a mile from downtown Bar Harbor, beginning on the ocean side of Main Street. And I misspoke. This is the one, then we're still on Mount Desert Island.
Yeah.
It's the next one that's off Mount Desert Island. Just a little bit. Anyways.
We need more drink.
Yes, something.
Now, day.
When you enter the trail, a strange atmosphere of spellbound silence takes over. As you pass by eerie shores and mysterious ruins, you may wonder about the lost world consumed by the Great Fire, and are those phantoms of the past with you on the trail? The park is clearly an overgrown part of a stately mansion that once stood here. The path follows a long avenue that is lined in places by quarried granite along a gloomy spring. The intense quiet of Compass Harbor makes one feel completely cut off from Bar Harbor. Now, Compass Harbor had the first formal gardens on all of Mount Desert Island. The rhododendrons, Japanese pine, and cedar grove are all left to grow wild. In the center of the grove are yew trees, ancient symbols of death and rebirth. Maybe this is why so many spirits linger here today. The specter of the caretaker lurks in the forking paths of the forest. He only appears in one's peripheral vision, but the image is always that of a dark-haired man in blue. He is seen quick as a flash and then gone, returning when least expected. His disappearance and reappearance make hikers in the area feel as though they are being stalked by the caretaker. Even though his behavior is seemingly threatening, he does not harm anyone, but watches obsessively over the forest and nearby ruins. As hikers get closer to the ruins of the mansion, they first cross by the remnants of the caretaker's house, located on a sunny knoll to the right. Only the hole of a sunken cellar and a pile of bricks from the chimney remain. Just past the caretaker's house is the ruins of the mansion and the beach beyond. The back veranda and the granite steps are all that is left of the haunting footprint of the once glorious mansion. The caretaker will flash in and out of here as well, but no further. Old Farm was the name of the mansion, a Queen Anne Victorian that was built in 1877. It survived the fire of 1947, only to be demolished 4 years later. The Dorr family, with their fortunes made in the East India trade out of Salem, built Old Farm. The paranormal has always had a place here. William James, a pioneer in the field of paranormal studies, visited the place, as did Edith Wharton, famous for her ghost stories. After the death of the Dorr sons, psychic mediums regularly conducted seances at the Old Farm to communicate with the dead. The last owner was George Bucknam Dorr, the father of Acadia National Park. Working with others, he made possible the protection of 35,000 acres of land into a stunning national park. As a landmark out at sea, Mount Desert Island contains an exceptionally rich history of early settlement and exploration. Without Dorr's leadership and personal sacrifices, these historic lands would not have been protected for the enjoyment of future generations. He began his work in 1901 and devoted the rest of his life, health, and personal fortune to the project. He bought many tracts of land that became part of the park, and he donated acreage he already owned, including the Compass Harbor Estate in 1942. At the end of his life, George Doerr spent nearly all of his enormous inheritance and had lost his sight completely. But in 1916, President Woodrow Wilson conferred the status of a national monument, and in 1919, the status of a national park. Doerr's dream had come true. During the final years of his life, he relied heavily on the assistance of his caretaker, John Rich, a man of fierce loyalty. When the money ran out, Doerr needed constant care and moved into the caretaker's cottage. Rich would help Doerr walk along the forested path or assist him down to the long granite staircase to the water's edge. On August 5, 1944, George Doerr suffered heart failure on one of these walks and passed away. While his spirit has moved on, John Rich's has not. It's possible that the caretaker's spirit may be one from an earlier cottage, Cousin's Farm, which was one of the first land grants on the island, but we can never know for sure. It is also to be noted that the funeral seen by the Jesuits in 1613 was on this shoreline in Compass Harbor. There is an ancient burial ground on the estate grounds. It is rumored to be near the old pool from Old Farm, and it is here another spirit roams. She is said not to appear Native American, yet no one knows her true form. She materializes at dusk as a young woman hurrying down the overgrown avenue through the haunted forest and past the ruins of Old Farm. Her destination is the shore, and if the moon has already risen, she can be seen walking down to the tip of Doerr Point, then disappearing into the sea. Beautiful Compass Harbor.
Yep, so that is how we got Acadia National Park.
Yep, he's one of the many. Of course, he's kind of very much overshadowed by the Rockefellers.
Yeah, they were the other big push behind
it. Yes, they put a whole lot of resources into
and
the
land.
Land.
And they still have a home up there, and you can still see Mr. Rockefeller go out in his carriage and drive around the park.
Yep.
Because his house is still on the park grounds.
Yep, so they still get out and about up there.
Yep. We'll get back there one day and go out on a horse ride.
It was a wonderful trip. We need to get back.
Yes, we do.
Now, this next one is the one that's just across the water from Bar Harbor.
This is Winter Harbor.
Winter Harbor.
Now, this is the setting for a dark tale of ghostly encounters that goes back for generations. It is only 4 miles from Bar Harbor by water, but it seems a world apart with its towering cliffs and 40-foot sprays of seawater. There seems to be a secret source of supernatural power linked to the land and to the people who live here in fear because of this ancient terror that just refuses to go away. In the center of the village, overlooking Frenchman Bay, the land rises to a point known as Bow Arrow Hill. For as long as the town members remember, this has been the setting for extreme psychic encounters. Strange orbs accompanied by a whirling sound appear in the area all the time. Almost everyone in Winter Harbor has seen them in the sky. The old houses built on Bow Arrow Hill are susceptible to sudden deafening, banging, and rattling, and sometimes the noises come from within the walls of the houses. It's not uncommon for the residents to jump up in terror in the middle of the night because their beds are shaking violently. The Bickford and Whitney families seem to have had the most experiences as they have lived on Bow Arrow Hill for generations. Their accounts include a central figure, a spiritual combatant, or a dark warrior. Betty Williams saw the phantom in the 1950s when she lived at Bickford House at the crest of the hill. She was 13 and had gone to the store to buy cigarettes for her father. When she returned, dusk had fallen and almost settled into night, but she could still see the shapes and the outlines in her surroundings. Car, she saw the black silhouette of a man. She approached the figure thinking it was her father. The black phantom turned and headed towards the attached barn of the house, and Betty followed, calling, "Dad, Dad!" The dark figure never stopped or turned around. He nearly led her into the pitch-black barn before Betty felt a sudden shudder of cold air and revulsion. She realized something was terribly wrong. She ran to the house, found her father inside. They returned, searched the barn, and the dark figure had disappeared. Linda Whitney, who also grew up in Bickford House, had her own unforgettable encounter with the specter in the 1960s. She, too, was 13. She was lying in bed when she heard loud footsteps overhead in the attic. The footsteps came down the stairs, and to her horror, she saw the phantom appear in her room. It appeared solid, the shape of a man composed entirely of darkness. The phantom walked across the room, brushed by her bed, and didn't stop. It was intent on getting to the window and looking out. Linda saw the curtains move as the ghost pulled them aside. The figure stood there for a few minutes, looking out on Bow Arrow Hill. As Linda watched the phantom at her window, petrified, it would turn around and see her. She instead saw it grow transparent and fade away. In 2002, another 13-year-old, Alex Whitney, had a chilling encounter with the dark figure of Bow Arrow Hill. He was in his room at Whitney House, which stands a couple hundred feet away from the Bickford House. It was early morning before the sun had risen, but he had woken up at the sound of a horse cantering down the street between the houses. It was summer, and his window was open, allowing him to hear the noise clearly. Strangely, the horse followed the road past the end of the avenue, only to turn around and gallop back the way it had come. At first, Alex thought his neighbor's horse had escaped his pasture and wandered into the village. Trying to go back to sleep, he listened to the horse go back and forth, back and forth. And then he remembered his neighbor had recently moved away, taking the horse with her. Then he heard the horse rearing up and whinnying. Alex was confused, and he got up and went to the window. When he looked out, he saw no horse, but movement in the upstairs window of the Bickford House caught his eye. Alex saw the dark figure of a man walking back and forth in front of the window. Strangely, the figure stepped out and picked up a black sphere, flung it through the wall of the house. The sphere seemed weightless, yet dropped to the ground. After throwing out another sphere, as well as a heavy-looking box, the dark figure walked away from the window. Moments later, Alex saw the ghost step into the second-floor wall of the house and proceed down a staircase that did not exist. Transfixed, his heart pounding, Alex watched the dark figure abruptly stop when he reached the ground. Turning slowly, the ghost looked directly at Alex. The phantom's gaze conveyed a feeling of evil so strong that Alex fled to a guest bedroom on the other side of the house, but the dark specter would soon follow him. His heart racing, Alex tried to calm his nerves by grabbing a book and starting to read it. As he started reading, a fierce windstorm swept down the outside and began howling around the vicinity of Bow Arrow Hill. Then Alex heard footsteps coming down the hall outside his door. Through a gap at the bottom, he saw a shadow of someone walk past the door. Something about the gate led him to believe this was not a living human being. Alex did not need to call out for help. The deafening sounds and the pounding and banging throughout the entire house summoned all the other members of the household. Alex was so insistent on the details of his story that the members of his family went to the local historical society and dug up old pictures of the Bickford House. One photo from the time the house was built in 1891 shows a door in the spot where Alex saw the figure step through the wall of the house. For more than 60 years, this door has been hidden, plastered over on the inside, and covered by shingles on the outside. Old Indian trails behind Bow Arrow Hill also lend support to Alex's memory of the horse running to a point beyond the end of the road. A trail once led from the bay directly up to the fields, now blocked by houses on Main Street. Native Americans have lived on the land in or around Winter Harbor for thousands of years, and it has even been informed that it actually has informed the meaning of the name Bow Arrow Hill. The oral history states that this place was once an Indian proving ground, a place of sporting events and ancient competitions. The proving ground is also a place of combat and competition against supernatural entities. The prehistoric Native American culture provided a central place to the tribal shaman to prove his or her mastery over the dangerous supernatural elements, and Bow Arrow Hill was chosen for this. The dark specter usually appears to 13-year-olds because this is the age when people go through their rites of passage into adulthood, an age at which shamans had to prove their powers of spiritual defense. Sometimes the secret lies within the name of the place as well. Bow Arrow Hill seems to refer to a bow and arrow. The name might be described as a bowed arrow. A bowed arrow symbolizes one that can fly or swerve into another world or a different dimension in order to track and kill its foe. Shamans from Acadia once a bow and arrow in intricate ceremonies of exorcism. Such encounters probably took place on Bow Arrow Hill, still plagued with the intense outbreaks of the paranormal. that at the center of the psychic whirlwind is the return of this dark figure, a spiritual opponent that persists in causing speechless terror.
Okay.
Okay. Do you have any questions? No questions?
Patrick asked something about, did you come across any stories related to coyotes?
Not in this book that I have, but we have another one for Maine that has some stories from this area, and I need to finish reading that one. So.
Okay.
Not yet.
Okay.
There's always a possibility.
Yeah. So, but yeah. Patrick, I'd be interested in it. Wrong screen. Patrick, I'd be interested in hearing, about what you might have, in mind, or what you might have seen about coyotes and whatnot. I'm curious. You piqued my interest.
Yeah, especially with the Native American lore that's from this area, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yes.
Because it is literally soaked into the land, as you can tell by the last story.
Mm-hmm. Oh. The last story, the one you just told.
Yeah.
Yes. We have one more story.
Yes.
Yeah, we have one more story to share with you tonight.
So. Chris didn't like the original one I found because it was too far away, so we found another one.
Yeah, well, then that's okay because we'll be able to share it on your next episode.
Yeah.
So. We'll get to that. We're getting way ahead of ourselves here. So, yes. Got one more story for you tonight before we go ahead and wrap things up for this week. But this one is called The Devil's Oven. Along the north coast of Mount Desert Island lies unfamiliar terrain. The coastline is a jagged stretch of broken stone that, while beautiful in its own right, is unlike the gracefully weathered granite that is commonly found across the island. The landscape conjures up images of the underworld with deposits of sulfur and iron, and these give the rocks a fiery look as the rocks rise up from the sea. Amongst the broken shoreline at the base of the cliffs, the waves have pecked out little ovens or demon caves, and amongst these recesses on the stone is a sea cave known as the Devil's Oven. Devil's Oven is a respectably sized sea cave with 10-foot ceilings and a gloomy interior. The inside offers stunning views of blue water framed by the dark maw of the cavern. From the outside, the cave resembles the eye sockets of a skull with two distinct entrances separated by a column of rock. The cave earned its original name from Native Americans living in the area long before English settlement. It is located between Hall's Cove, also known as Hell's Cove,
which you mentioned before,
yep, and Salisbury Cove, and it is not easily accessible. The cave is also under the water much of the time due to tide. The path to the oven has its own ill-named landmarks, including the cathedral, which is a massive detached wall of cliff, which is home to Via Mala, a corrupted Latin term which roughly translates to the evil way or road to evil. The accounts tell of unmistakable evil and dark, horrific rituals that took place in the Devil's Oven. It is dangerous ground, and one must approach the Devil's Oven and its neighboring Hell's Cove with caution, if not some form of spiritual protection. When it comes to potential gateways to the supernatural, the Devil's Oven is the most infamous of them on Mount Desert Island. This sea cave has been the setting for ghostly encounters for thousands of years. The Native Americans reported seeing strange lights coming from the Devil's Oven, like glowing orbs or great fires burning inside the cavern, regardless of whether or not the place was underwater. In fact, they shunned the area. If circumstances required them to go there, they wore charms and took other proactive measures. They believed the rocks contained portals or entryways to hell, and the Devil's Oven was the main gateway. Before Christian missionaries visited the shores, the Native Americans had their own beliefs and their own version of hell, which was a place of darkness inhabited by terrifying entities and tormented souls. Strange lights and sounds are still reported in and around Devil's Oven. Accounts from the 1880s testify to a weird, lurid light that might be seen gleaming and flashing out from under the cliffs towards Frenchman Bay, in the area of Devil's Oven. People have also heard the cries of tormented souls in strange words and chants spoken in abhorrent tongues. Fishermen today report seeing the mysterious lights burning from inside sea caves. The common belief is that if you see the lights, danger will befall you. The cave's ancient purpose was for dark rites involving agonizing deaths by being buried alive or burned alive inside a literal oven. As crazy as this might sound, it is documented in historical records. The gruesome practice was reserved for people viewed as especially heinous or dangerous. More feared than the torturous death was the danger of damnation, for the oven could reputedly devour a soul, pulling it literally into hell. No one will ever know the true number of people buried alive or burned alive in the devil's oven. The ashes were washed away with every tide, but the soot and smoke can be seen and smelled in the cavern today. There is one detailed eyewitness account of one of these rituals, as the intended target survived to tell the tale. Back in the 18th century, there was a hunter-trapper in the area by the name of Isaac Winslow. The local Mi'kmaq Indians justifiably hated Isaac Winslow, for he was a notorious mercenary during the French and Indian War, hunting Native Americans for a bounty. During one of his trips into the area, Winslow encountered a group of Mi'kmaq natives who captured him and killed the group of missionaries under his command. To the dreaded sea tavern went Winslow, bound and gagged, and there his captors lashed him to a wooden stake driven deep into the pebbled floor of the cave. A pile of sticks and brush was heaped around the stake, and at last it was set on fire. The man would be consumed in body by the flame and in soul by the devil himself. As night fell, the natives grew increasingly uneasy. The wood that they had brought to the cavern was damp, and the fire burned slowly, although it created a great plume of smoke. Hearing what lurked in the shadows of the cave after dark, even with their protective paints and talismans, they avoided the cave after sundown. They finally left their enemy by the smoldering fire, figuring that if the flames did not consume him, that the oncoming tide would finish the job. Casting off hurriedly in canoes, the natives left Winslow to his doom. Amazingly, he survived the ordeal, for the rising tide not only extinguished the flames, but the subsequent buoyancy in Winslow's squirming to get free dislodged the stake from the floor of the cave. Winslow escaped and shared his harrowing tale. The ghastly accounts in the history of Mount Desert Island testify to traditions of horror at the Devil's Oven. Without a doubt, they contribute to the supernatural sightings that plague the area. If a phantom fire start up, then pray for a speedy deliverance while you frantically scramble to leave the place. And remember, don't look back.
So, Patrick, yes, you did mention Kaya. I do know who you're referring to now. I actually used to teach about him when I taught mythology to my English students.
Well,
no, I have not actually run across any tales of him in the Northeast yet.
Yeah. Yes, I've heard many a tale, many a coyote Native American tale.
The deity. Yeah.
Okay. Got it.
Yeah.
But yeah, not,
most of those I've heard out west, but
yeah.
not in the East.
Not in the Northeast, no. Or not in the East at all, really.
Yeah.
But yes, I've seen many tales, many accounts, in the desert Southwest and the upper Great Plains.
Yes.
So.
But we'll keep looking. We might.
Yeah. That might be a topic for a future one.
Yep.
But speaking of future ones, we do have our topic booked up for the next one.
Yes, we're going to go visit some haunted cemeteries because it's spooky time.
Yes.
So what's more spooky than a haunted cemetery?
I don't have any coyote stories, but I do have a third-hand headless dog story. Yeah, we know what you're talking about, Patrick. I was just a little confused at first because I didn't know if you had any coyote stories specifically related to Mount Desert Island and Acadia National Park. But, yes.
Yeah.
So we got you. We know what you're talking about. We're all good. But, yeah.
I didn't have that much straight. Yeah.
No.
Gosh. Hey, Steve.
You wrapped up a little quick tonight. 50 minutes.
Woohoo. Sure night.
Woohoo. They tune in for us.
I know. But we ran long the last few times. So
yeah.
Balance it out.
Yeah, ran a good hour and a half the last couple of times. So trying to balance it out, trying to find that sweet spot. I don't know, maybe this is something that we need to do short bursts, 30-minute storytelling sessions a little more frequently or something.
Well, once we get through October, there might be more time.
We'll figure it out.
Yeah.
We'll get there.
Yeah.
We'll get there. But yeah, awesome.
And we just got 3 new ghost story books this past weekend at Paracon. So more research material.
Yeah, we got more Ghosts of the Civil War. We got the book about the Hinsdale House, which you mentioned at the beginning.
Both of them.
Oh, there's both of them were Hinsdale.
Yeah.
I hadn't had a chance to have a close look.
Yeah, one is written by Daniel. The other one is written by family members. It's taken from journals of people who have lived there.
Interesting.
Yeah. And the Civil War ghost ones that we picked up, these are ghost stories that were reported in the newspapers during the Civil War.
Yep.
Which makes it even more fun.
Yeah. The author was there. She was really nice.
She was great.
Most of what she's written is actually nonfiction. Nonfiction. Ghost story. Okay. It's verifiable absolute fact is most of what she's written. Then she's got her ghost stories book.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you know, very, very nice author. And
I can't wait to read these.
Yes. So we'll when we get to the point of actually featuring maybe some of those stories, we'll show off the book.
Oh, darn, I had to buy books with a company credit card.
Darn. Expanding the research library even more.
And we got them signed at the same time. Because that's what we do.
Speaking of the research library, where are we going to store all these books?
I need to purge. I kept looking off over here to see if I had my Native American mythology book still. I think that might have been one of the ones I gifted to the library.
I guess if we just start turning some of them sideways.
Yeah. As I said, I need to purge.
We could stack them like you stacked your romance novels.
Yeah.
This massive.
Hey,
massive
I've heard
stack
those
of
before.
Romance before. Novels. But yeah, yeah.
I'm getting shit the wrong way.
Love you, dear. So yeah, we'll be back in 2 weeks with Haunted Cemetery.
Yeah.
We already have those stories started, and lots of spooky books.
Yeah,
lots of stuff to read. And this next month will be very busy for us. So maybe these next couple of sessions might be
a little shorter,
just a little on the shorter side. But we will keep to our schedule. We'll go every couple of weeks. So we will see you again in 2 weeks, and we will see what the situation is with kitty cats and whatnot at that point in time.
Yeah.
But, as of last time the kennel was set up and Yuna was in there, she's healing up quite nicely from her surgery. She's bouncing all over the place.
Wouldn't know she had surgery two weeks ago.
Just right back to her normal self. And, we'll look forward to being able to show off.
Yes, Patrick, book pyramid.
Book pyramid.
Problem is the cat. They will bounce right off of it, and it'll be a book fly.
Well, we got all these shelves in here. We'll have to show off these shelves from time. They're all back behind the camera here, and got quite the stacks of books going.
Yeah, it needs to be neatened up.
Yeah,
that's a project.
I'm looking at. I got college textbooks over there.
Yeah, you do.
Mm.
And we have a shelf that needs to go up over there.
Yes, we do.
That'll help.
This room is a disaster.
It's the catch-all room.
Yeah. Anyways, we're rambling.
Yes, we are. All right.
We haven't finished our drinks. We love talking.
Yes, we do. And
we love talking to you.
We're hopefully going to go on another ghost tour soon after Thanksgiving.
Yes.
When we have time.
We'll get to that.
Yes.
We'll inside secret. We'll share it with you eventually. We'll get there. We'll tell you all about it.
And we might do a little Facebook Live from a paranormal investigation with our crew.
We've got a little something on the books not on the books yet. It will get on the books.
The new year, so that'll be a little fun Facebook Live thing that we'll probably do.
Yep, just a little tease. You'll have to tune in.
We need to tell our guys first.
Some of them know. Not all of them. One of them.
One knows.
One. It's some. Some is more than none. One is more than none, which makes it some.
Yes. Anyway.
Anyways, yes.
So we got some things coming down the chute. Let's see. Investigation November.
Yep. We got the one on the battleship Wisconsin down in Norfolk.
Yes. And the same night, two of our guys are going to be at another investigation in Norfolk.
In Norfolk at the Masonic Lodge down there. So
that'll be a night of investigations. We might have to do a little quick Facebook Live.
Oh, we will absolutely do a little hello. Shame on us, we didn't do one while we were at Paracon.
We didn't.
I did a post, but I didn't go live.
You didn't go poke around with the camera?
No. Shame on me.
Next time.
Next time. And there will be next time. We're not going anywhere. Yeah. We'll be here doing the spooky stuff for
a while.
A good long job. It is your job. It's a fun job, though.
It is.
It's your only job. Well, no, not your only job.
It's my full-time job.
She makes awesome coffee, too. I never knew I'd be married to a barista. I'm not complaining.
Not when I bring him scones.
No, scones and, ooh, if you want to bring me some coffee next time. We're rambling again.
Chris has been drinking Christmas morning from Hardy Woods.
Yes. It aged quite nicely. So, local beer tonight, Christmas morning. I guess next year's batch of Christmas morning will probably come out and hit the shelves in a couple months. Early to mid-November.
Yeah, so a month.
Yeah.
I've been drinking rum and Coke.
Yeah, a month, because it's basically the end of September.
Yeah. Anyway.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers. We're going to let you all go for the night. We'll see you in 2 weeks for Haunted Cemeteries. Till then, stay spooky. Come visit us on a tour.
Yep. And for that matter, you can come see us on a tour. You can shoot us a note anytime. Yeah, drop us a Facebook message. Shoot us an email, whatever. We love hearing from y'all. And if there is a particular subject that you want us to try and research and do one of these episodes on,
please let us know.
We're basically kind of just...
What do I have in my Pinterest library and what do I have downstairs?
We're kind of doing, the whole shooting darts at a map to figure out where you're going to go. That's basically how we choose what ghost stories we're going to be sharing on it. So, yeah, if you want to give that metaphorical dark map a break, drop us a note.
Just
shoot us a theme or a location that you'd like us to talk about, and we will do the research. So,
with that. Cheers, y'all. Have a good night.
Good night, everybody.
Until I heard the old man's happiness speak.